This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, it was a record-breaking week on Wall Street. For the third time in history, a president gets impeached. Well, sort of. The articles actually haven't been sent to the Senate. So technically, there is no impeachment until that happens. But the market seems to like it as all major indexes powering forward into record territory. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me on the program will be John Kosar from Asbury Research. He's saying a broad swath of rising indexes, not just here in the U.S., but around the globe. He also sees rising interest rates hinting at a stronger economy in 2020, and his Asbury 6 is looking positive, with all six indicators pointing to more gains in the market. Also on the program, Daniel DiMartino Booth will be joining me. She said last year the Fed got caught off guard when they were raising rates, especially the fourth increase in the month of December. Well, there's been a sea change at the Fed about face that they did at the beginning of the year, and the Fed is now expanding its balance sheet rapidly. She also points out that we have had two industrial recessions, and this expansion, even though the economy is still moving forward, and Q1 still looks good. Later on in the program, both Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava will be bringing you another edition of Smart Macro, and of course, what moved the markets this week? All of that coming up in today's program.
Sitting in for Ryan Poplava, who's on vacation, I'm Chris Prytower with the weekly market wrap-up report. Now, on Friday, U.S. stocks advanced toward new highs. This was seemingly powered by new signs of economic strength after trade tensions relaxed. The S&P 500 added 0.5%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 0.4%. The NASDAQ Composite also gained 0.4%. All three stock indexes are showing strength, and this really seems based on the U.S. and Chinese preliminary trade truce. There have also been economic reports from both countries. Those reports seem to have further eased fears of a global slowdown. Now, in another bit of good news, U.S. household spending rose in November, and that's being seen as a sign that this main driver of the economy is remaining solid as we head into the end of the year. And the Commerce Department said Friday that personal consumption expenditures rose a seasonally adjusted 0.4%, while personal income increased 0.5%. That's a greater income gain than was expected. And spending in November was up 2.4% from a year earlier. Now, if you've been following this program for any length of time, you know that U.S. stocks have had a banner year. Part of that is the shift to lower interest rates, and as already mentioned, the signs of progress in trade negotiations. But in 2019, the S&P 500 has advanced 29%, while the NASDAQ Composite has jumped 34%. Now, the stock gains on Friday, they were broad-based. All 11 S&P 500 sectors rose. They were led by advances in consumer staples and energy. Now, investors are closely watching the government attempt to reduce drug prices, and that's really by politicians from both parties. The Trump administration is moving ahead with a plan to allow cheaper drugs to be imported from Canada and other countries, but shares of biotech companies have surged in recent months, and the NASDAQ Biotechnology Index has gained 22% so far this quarter. That's far outpacing the S&P 500's almost 8% gain. The House of Representatives approved President Trump's amended North American Trade Pact on Thursday. It was an overwhelmingly bipartisan vote, a very rare thing to observe in this era where everything is so politically divisive. The House approved legislation to implement the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. The Senate is expected to pass the legislation early, after which the president would sign it into law. Now, speaking of the president, we have news that may possibly be a Financial Sense exclusive. You've probably not heard of this. Just let your friends and family know you heard it here first. The president of the United States was impeached. He's the third president to be impeached, so it's quite historic, but the next step will be Nancy Pelosi pushing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell toward what she considers a fair hearing on the impeachment articles. So the House adjourned for the year on Thursday without sending articles to the Senate, which would automatically trigger a trial. And now the impeachment event does not appear to be negatively impacting the market, historic nonetheless. That's it for the weekly wrap-up report. Ryan Poplava will be joining us next week to let us know what moved the market. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
But hydrogen is attractive because it's available all over the world from widely available resources, and it can be produced with potentially very low or zero emissions and at high efficiency. The big challenge currently is the cost of production, but if the technology can come along and if there were to be supportive policy, then the use of hydrogen in the long-term future could help to significantly decarbonize the future energy system.
Did you know that municipal bonds can provide you with a predictable source of income that is free from both federal and state income taxes? If you're in a high tax bracket, municipal bonds could be the right investment choice for you. If you have more than $500,000 to invest, our portfolio managers can create a municipal bond portfolio designed to align with your financial goals. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939 now and add tax-free bonds to your portfolio. That's 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, only a day after a historical impeachment, markets are hitting record highs. Santa Claus apparently has arrived this Christmas. And will we have a prosperous new year? Joining us on the program from Asbury Research is John Kosar. John, you have a group of indicators that are sort of your key metrics you kind of watch on the market. You call them your Asbury Six. Let's begin with that. What does the Asbury Six look like now, and what are they telling you?
Sure. We actually have two. We have a kind of a black box model that has done very well since 2011 called CPM, or Correction Protection Model. And then we have the Asbury Six is a little more transparent. And it's six of our favorite indicators that we've had back-tested. We actually had a larger group that we had back-tested to see which ones worked the best together. And the purpose of this was to kind of look at the market from six different angles, so to speak, so you get more of a comprehensive and accurate view of what the condition of the market is. It's a tactical. These are both tactical models. But Asbury 6 has been positive since October the 15th, and CPM went to risk on the 17th. So they caught the market kind of coming out of the congestion area. They did a pretty good job, actually, of getting on top of the market just when it was coming out of that congestion area that we had been in since the 1st of May and all that chop.
You know, one of the things that is we're starting to see, at least over the last 6 weeks or so in the market, John, if we take a look at the beginning of the year, you had all the what I call the risk-on sectors. You had staples, utilities, and REITs, plus technology leading the market. Now, as I look at the S&P sectors, just about every single sector, even energy, which has been sort of a laggard, is starting to pick up. And then also, when you look at within the S&P, the small cap, mid cap, they're going up. The international indexes are going up from emerging markets. So when you see a broad swath of indexes, not only here, sectors, as well as indexes around the globe all rising, what does that tell you?
Well, it tells you risk on. Usually what I do is, you know, before I get on the phone with you, I usually go back to the last interview and see what we talked about, you know, and see if we can kind of build a chain across the two dates. And the last time I was on, it was really interesting what was going on. The stock market was chopping all over the place. We just finished a really choppy August, and the S&P was sitting on the 200-day moving average and looking kind of sloppy. Steel prices were down. Copper prices were down. You know, commodity prices were down. Energy was weak. Since then, really since about the middle of October when our models turned, you even saw steel prices getting stronger. Copper miners, we just hit our target in copper miners. COPX is the ETF. It was like 7 or 8% above the market. Everything turned on a dime. And a lot of the foreign markets we look at started to do better. One of the models we have, it looks at the S&P 500 relative to 24 different foreign markets. And we update this once a week. And last week, outperforming the spider on either a tactical basis for us or a strategic basis for us, we had New Zealand, Taiwan, United Kingdom, South Korea, Brazil, China, and Russia. Sectors are doing better, like you said. So something happened, and we could argue as to what it was, but I can tell you what time it was. And basically, from the end of September to the middle to latter part of October, things turned. Things got better. So there's kind of an undergirding here that has taken place. It's just not a Santa Claus rally or the market getting happy in the fourth quarter. Something tangibly changed where the risk appetite globally made a noticeable change during that time period. I find that very interesting. And for me, it's not so much scratching my chin and trying to figure out exactly why. You know, we don't get paid for why. You know, we get paid for which direction the market is and to be on it. And I mean, it was very apparent to us during that time frame that something big changed.
Yeah, because if you take a look at it, it's hard to believe, as you talked about that choppy period of time in August, we saw 10-year Treasury yields go from where we were last year at 3.25%, almost down to 1.4%, almost to the lows of 2016 in August. And here we are close to 2%. So let's move over for a bit and talk about interest rates. What do you guys see in the charts there? Some people are saying we could hit 2%, maybe go up to 2.25%. What do you see?
Rates have been very unusual over this past most of the year, from our standpoint, very unusual behavior. We've been having, there's a lot of strategic indicators that we track that are usually very good, 1 to 2 quarter indication of where rates are going. Stuff like TIPS break-evens and relative performance between our treasury bonds and Eurobonds and a number of other things that just have not worked this year. This year has just really seemed to be driven by, I think, more Fed watching than normal. Certainly a lot more thumb on the scale or attempted thumb at the scale coming from Washington in terms of trying to push interest rates down. So, and I'm still seeing that now. I mean, if you look since really August 30th, we've been around 170 on the 10-year, and we're starting to creep back up now. Looking across at my screen, we're 191. I'm looking at it as kind of an indication that I think the market has stabilized there. I think people kind of have a sense of what the Fed's doing. It sounds like the Fed's going to be on hold for all practical purposes through much of, if not all of next year. That whole space has really stabilized. And the next level that I'm looking at upstairs is about 205 to 216. And that's the big level as far as I'm concerned for the next 1 to 2 quarters. If we take that out, I think you're talking 260. I mean, obviously, I think in order for us to get that high, you know, the economy would have to globally, I think, the economy would have to get even stronger. And then on the flip side of 170, which doesn't appear to be in any immediate danger now, you're looking at 150 to 137. And 137 is basically, as far as my charts go back, they go back to 1900. And that 137-ish area is a low that we've hit three or four times. The first time that we hit it during that span was 3 months after World War II ended, and then a couple of times here just over the past decade. So that's kind of what we're looking at there with rates. But I get the sense that there was a lot of angst, obviously, there over the summer. I think the interest rate markets have stabilized. They're starting to go higher. And I look at that similar to what I see when I see a dozen foreign stock indexes stabilizing and some starting to outperform the U.S. It just looks like the world has stabilized and is starting to improve economically.
You know, one thing, I want to come back to the market before we head on to the dollar and commodities. And if we take a look at the trade until this changed in October, John, it was the kind of risk-off type of trades that we saw with staples. But the one exception, and has been just on a power surge since the beginning of the year, has been technology. So explain the divergence between that, because we had sort of, you know, that angst that you talked about, especially coming out of last year, given what the Fed was doing. But it seemed like money managers were moving into staples, REITs. You could call it either an interest rate play or a safety play, consumer staples. And even staples continue to power forward along with technology.
Yeah, tech's been a real juggernaut. As you're talking to me, I'm kind of, you know, frantically flipping to pages of our research that I've written over the past several weeks or looking at a chart. And the one I pulled up is Apple. Apple's the poster boy. I mean, everyone was looking at Amazon, or I certainly was. I was kind of looking at Amazon and wringing my hands and saying, you know, Amazon just doesn't seem to be getting in the game here. But then you look at Apple, and Apple actually broke out higher. We were talking to clients about a breakout in Apple back middle to latter part of August, when Apple was trading about 210. The target that I had was 291. It was just a technical target that was based on the resumption of Apple's bigger trend, you know, that started many years ago. And when I said 291, I had some clients look at me like I was nuts because it was quite a move from 210. I'm looking at Apple now and we're trading at 279.50. You know, we're knocking on the door here. In the meantime, the stocks has really taken off. Semiconductors have taken off. Biotech is taking off. And when I mean, generally speaking, those places in the market are usually the tip of the spear. That's an indication of appetite for risk. And all of that stuff really started to take off. I mean, I'm looking at Apple. Apple broke out, what I say, at the end of August. Biotech actually broke out a couple of weeks ago. We're up 9 or 10% on that. So it just looks like risk appetite. Something tangibly changed in the world at the end of the third quarter, and risk appetite just got dialed up.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, you know, looking at Apple, it began the year, ended the last year at 155. Here we are at almost close to 280 on the day you and I are doing this interview. I mean, this stock's up 80% this year.
Crazy. It's just crazy.
Yeah, you haven't seen anything like that since probably going back to 1999.
No, I mean, I'm thinking Texas Instruments had a big, probably not as large in terms of sheer dollars, but it had a similar, a couple of years ago, Texas Instruments had a move. So every once in a while, you know, you'll catch one of these stocks that's been going sideways for 6 months, 9 months, a year, and you'll get that breakout. And sometimes these things just really go. There's been others. You know, there's another one that isn't talked about much, but another one that we've been watching was Walmart. And Walmart actually broke out and kind of resumed its bigger trend that started in mid-2015 in the middle of the summer. It had a pullback in August, you know, when everything else was getting whacked. But I mean, I still have a $130 per share target in Walmart. And what are we trading at here? 120? I still have some major, large cap monster stocks that really tend to, you know, sometimes drag the market around with them, and they still have upside targets. So I don't think this is over yet. I can tell you that we had targets in the middle of October of 8,600 in NDX, which is the 100, and 8,800 in the comp, the NASDAQ composite. Both of those targets were met. So some of my tech targets are getting met. I would say if you're looking at this as a ball game that started in September, it looks like we might be in the seventh or eighth inning, and I think we could get some kind of a pullback into that typical seasonal weakness time, which begins middle of January and runs through February. But otherwise, I'm really impressed by what I see. I mean, I'm turning over rocks, and looking for warning signs, and I'm not seeing a whole lot right now.
Everybody's talked about Amazon and how they disrupted the retail space. But if you look at the charts of, you just talked about Walmart, you can see the same in Target, you can see the same in Costco. I mean, they kind of almost look like the charts of Apple.
Yes, they do. It's been a really odd year in that sense, in that just, from May to August, the market couldn't pick its head up, and then something lit the candle and it just took off. And it was there to see, like I said, our tactical models, our CPM and our Asbury 6, which are very sensitive to, to peaks, they're set to the month, and they're very good at letting you know when the market is getting vulnerable. They turned positive on October 15th, never looked back. And another thing I noticed is the big flush of assets going into the spiders just over the past month or so. Just a tremendous flush of money going into spiders just here, the latter part of the fourth quarter. So all I can think of is risk appetite right now. Steel prices have totally exploded. You're seeing a lot of the industrial metals, XME, which is a metals and mining ETF. That's been a pick of ours for the past couple of months. That's taken off like a shot. So again, I don't know what happened, and we could all come up with our own ideas as to what happened, but risk appetite got the volume turned up on it big time in September and October.
Well, let's talk about the commodities and dollar. I'm looking at a chart of copper breaking out. Even oil has picked up. You mentioned steel. And on the other side of it, we've seen a downturn in the dollar. So let's talk about commodities for a minute.
I mentioned copper miners. We had put an idea out to buy copper miners very beginning of November. That's hit its target already. We've had a target 7-8% up above the market, actually 2025. It touched on that target and it's backed off a little bit. So that's already met its objective. XME is the metals and mining ETF. We put an idea out there middle of November, and it's rallied 3-4% since there. It's trading around $29. I've got it going to 32. I mentioned steel. We actually put the idea out in steel right about that same time frame, first, second week of November. Steel's trading at 38.5. SLX, I should say, is the ETF for that. I've got that going to 40-50. So some of these still have legs that I think can extend into the first quarter of next year. On the flip side of that, whenever I put on long ideas, especially in the commodity space, I like to try to put some short ideas on so I can offset that. And we actually put out a short idea in Nat Gas. We're actually looking at UNG is the ETF, for Nat Gas. That's trading at about, we put that idea on about $19. It's trading about $17.30, and I've got it going to $14.25. So that's kind of the fly in the ointment, so to speak, in the commodity space. But again, it's such a large space. To me, if you can put some ideas on both long and short, you almost hedge yourself up a little bit, to a degree, instead of going all in for commodities going up and down.
Final question, if I may. When you see such a broad-based trend as we're seeing now, I don't care if you're looking at sectors, you're looking at commodities, you're looking at international indexes, individual sectors within the S&P. John, if you were to take a peek into 2020, given where we are now, what would be your best guess?
My best guess is, and again, I hate doing this because there's so much geopolitics out there. I don't like throwing darts. I don't like to throw darts. But we're in the 11th year of a bull market in the U.S. that usually lasts 4.5. Interest rates are still pretty low. I mean, it seems like interest rates have really come off of the canvas. But I mean, if you look at twos tens, we're like at 22, 23 basis points. And, we're at 190, let's call it 191 in the 10-year, we're not that far from a place where we could go back to and everybody would be saying, we're at 100-year lows, my God. My sense is this. I think we're going to get some kind of a pullback in January, February, because that's the seasonal time to do it. And just this appetite for risk is just, it's just been a juggernaut. And I think the market needs to take a breath. After April and May, when you get into that kind of seasonal low through the summer, I'm going to be looking really hard and turning over rocks and looking at stuff like our CPM and our Asbury 6 for an indication that we could have some kind of a scary second half. You know, we're going into the election. It might be after the election. I don't know. But I just don't think this lasts forever. And I think for people that are, you know, both of us are working with a lot of older investors, I think, you know, that have accumulated some wealth over their life and it's important for them to keep it. I think you really got to be on your toes next year because I think one of these times there's going to be a move down and everyone's going to, you know, just kind of slough it off as just being another little wiggle. And it's going to be something that can hurt people. So I just think what I'd say to investors next year is, you know, get some tactical tools and have an exit plan, because when the market goes up for this long, you know, interest rates are this low, geopolitics being what they are, I'm afraid one of these days we're going to get a bear market here and it's not going to be 3%, it's going to be 30%. And I think you got to be aware of that.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, if you take a look at how much political headlines from presidential tweets have dominated the markets this year, and next year being a presidential election year, things could get ugly. Well, listen, John, as we close, if people like to know more about Asbury Research, tell them how they can find out more about the work that you do.
Best thing to probably start with is to go to the website, asburyresearch.com. If you'd like to speak with me or somebody here, ask a question, find out about our services, there's a contact tab all the way to the right on the landing page of the website. There's a little text box there. Feel free to contact us through there, or a phone call is fine. And what we're going to do, so we're going to do something different here from now through the end of the year, and this will be for new subscribers only. We're going to offer 20% off of either a 3-month or an annual research subscription to Financial Sense listeners. We'll only hold it through the 31st. You know, through New Year's Eve, and it's limited. We don't have an unlimited amount of these, but we're holding some aside. So if you've been looking at this or listening to us and wanting to try us, this is the time where you could do it and save 20%.
Great idea. Well, listen, John, Merry Christmas and a happy, prosperous New Year. Look forward to talking to you next year.
Yes, Merry Christmas to you. It's always fun doing your show. I look forward to next year.
All right, John, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
With stocks hitting record highs in a phase one trade deal now secure between U.S. and China, there has been more and more talk of a melt-up or a blow-off top in the stock market as we head into 2020. We delved into this idea a bit more and looked at whether or not these fears by a number of different strategists of a stock market melt-up are founded or not, talking about investor positioning and other things with Cliff Droke. He is the editor of the weekly Momentum Strategies report and a regular guest on the program going back for many years. Cliff is pushing back on this idea of a melt-up. And actually, he's saying that if we do see one, it may not occur in the stock market, but in another very undervalued asset class. Here's a clip of what he told listeners on FS Insider this week.
If you recall, the last time a president was impeached, I believe it was December of 1998, and it was a full year before the bull market of the late 90s topped out. As long as you have this much political divisiveness, this much uncertainty over the political outlook, and a president being impeached is pretty serious. That alone is going to act as a bullish catalyst because, you know, as we all know, a bull market needs a wall of worry. And there's plenty of political worries right now to keep the bull intact. And that also will, as you said, keep participation rates a lot lower among the public.
So if you want to hear this full interview with Cliff Droke, in addition to our three FS Insider interviews every week that you can access through our website on financialsense.com or through a podcast app on your mobile device, all you got to do is go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Well, it looks like it's going to be a Merry Christmas for investors this year. It's hard to believe that a little over a year ago, just about everything on the screen was looking red. Now it's looking green, so it looks like Santa Claus has arrived. But will it be permanent? Joining us on the program is Danielle DiMartino Booth. And Danielle, I want to begin and just go back in time a bit to where we were at this time last year. The Fed was very hawkish. They had raised rates three times, and in the month of December, they raised it the fourth. All markets were down. And then within a two-week period of time in January, a complete 180-degree pivot. You've worked for the Fed. What was the Fed thinking going into December? And then what caused them to change so dramatically in January that quickly?
Well, so I think that what happened to the Fed is they were caught off guard by what happened in the overnight lending market and decided to really take a different tack. I'm in the process of putting together Quill's 2020 outlook, and I think investors should step back and appreciate that this is a sea change at the Fed. Jay Powell's approach to the financial markets is a complete departure from what Alan Greenspan or Ben Bernanke or Janet Yellen would have done. They were philosophically of a mind that you wait until after a bubble bursts to address the aftermath. Jay Powell's looking at this and approaching it in a much more proactive way. And I think that is why we are seeing such a dramatic reaction in the stock market.
And Danielle, do you think that comes from the fact that he's been a banker? In other words, he's not a PhD academic coming out of Harvard or Stanford like many of his predecessors. In other words, maybe a more practical approach?
I think that you've hit the nail right there, because he understands and he understood back in October of 2012, public comments during an FOMC meeting. They're released with a five-year lag. But back in October of 2012, he worried as a rookie on the committee, he said, you know what, we're blowing a fixed income duration bubble across the entire credit spectrum, and this could be problematic when we go to raise rates and normalize one day. So he was extremely aware, coming from the private equity side of the world. He has friends in the hedge fund community. He understands credit markets. And of all people inside the Fed, may have been the least surprised by what happened in mid-September with what we're now calling repo madness.
Not only did he do a 180 pivot, getting caught by surprise, as you mentioned, but then also they announced that they were going to wind down QT. And let's talk about what went on in the repo market in September and where the Fed is now injecting money, basically expanding their balance sheet again.
They are expanding their balance sheet at a very rapid rate. If they keep going, it's going to be as if quantitative tightening never happened to begin with, which I will remind you was a 21-month process. That is how rapidly the Fed is moving. And, you know, I put a little bit of this on to John Williams, who was always a pure academic running the San Francisco Fed. I didn't think that it was a wise move on Powell's part to advocate for a pure academic coming to run the New York Fed, just in case there were any hiccups in the financial markets that an academic didn't know how to handle. And then we had September the 17th and repo rates spike up to almost double digit levels. So, I mean, the thing is, a market veteran would have known that they had just resolved the debt ceiling and that therefore, in simple terms, the Treasury's checking account at the Federal Reserve had been almost depleted. They were about to get, you know, you've bounced a check notice, if you will. But during the negotiation of the debt ceiling, the Treasury depleted its checking account balance held at the Federal Reserve. So Fed officials were well aware that it had to be replenished when that deal was completed. And every single quarter, corporations have to make quarterly tax payments. So again, that also was not a shocking surprise to Fed officials. They knew that these two factors were coming together at the same time and should have been more prepared. And it was obvious that they were not, because overnight lending rates spiked as much as they did as a result of reserves being depleted to too great an extent. That was a combination of three things. I'm not going to get too far into the weeds. We've had currency in circulation rising for years. We've had foreign central banks dealing with negative interest rates in their homelands, parking increased amounts of deposits at the Fed to get that uptick in yield. And we also had in the background quantitative tightening. All three of these separate factors drained reserves to a level that we found out in mid-September was too low.
So as we look at where we are today, it seems like, you know, this is the thing that really strikes me. They spent a whole year quantitative tightening, raised rates four times, and it looks like very quickly, as you mentioned, they're reversing almost everything they did in 2018, which brings us to where we are now. Danielle, typically when you see recessions, you see bear markets, the result of three things: the Fed over-tightening, an overheated economy, a bubble in the markets, or a spike in oil prices. Doesn't seem like any of those exist today.
No, they don't. And I think that this is, look, take me out to the woodshed and shoot me if I say it's different this time, because nobody should ever use those words. But I do think that there is a perception, and rightly so, that this is a different approach than anything we've seen. And that is why markets are behaving as they are. Again, Alan Greenspan made a speech in 1996. You remember it. He said, irrational exuberance. And, you know, had Alan Greenspan been Jay Powell, he would have raised margin requirements at the time if he was trying to be preemptive. Instead, Alan Greenspan just let the internet bubble grow bigger and bigger, inflate more and more, because he was of the mind that he couldn't address the bubble until after it burst. So right now, financial markets are trying to digest this completely different approach of trying to be preemptive and get out in front of what Jay Powell knows darn well is a huge credit market bubble.
So as we look at this going forward, and let's take a look at 2020, as you look at 2020, the Fed has basically said in its recent meeting that the bar for lowering interest rates is pretty low. The bar for raising interest rates is pretty high. So typically, the Fed is reluctant to do anything major in a presidential election year. What do you think happens in 2020?
Jim, I'm going to have to correct you, and you're going to forgive me, but you're going to walk away. We're all going to be edified.
Okay.
11 of the last 12 election years, the Fed has been active. 11 of the last 12 election years going back in history. So that is a myth. I don't think that Jay Powell would risk anything happening in the credit markets if he was to see that the real economy is beginning to weaken anew. We don't know exactly what this trade phase deal, phase one, whatever they're calling it, we don't know what it's going to accomplish, mainly because the Chinese have never even been capable of buying as many agricultural products as what's been promised. And we don't know if the damage that's already done to the European economy can necessarily be undone. We don't know if the shifts in the Chinese economy and among Chinese domestic consumers is driven wholly by the trade war. We you know, there's plenty of evidence to suggest it started prior to Trump's first tweet.
So Danielle, given where we are today, interest rates look like they're going to stay where they are right now. Who knows if they lower them into next year? Given where the markets are, we're hitting record after record. Liquidity is being provided in the market. In your perspective, what should investors be doing at this point? I mean, in our own firm, we're looking for fallen angels in the bond market. We're looking for beaten up sectors that have value rather than just chasing the markets at this point.
Well, so I think you have to be very careful. I saw a very simple chart come out of Goldman Sachs. I'm putting it into my 2020 outlook. And if you look at the rally since 2009, the one that started way back in March 2009, none of us can remember anymore. 68% of that rally has been as a direct result of earnings growth since March of 2009. 32% has come from valuation expansion. So stay with me just a second. If you isolate the year 2019 alone, 8%, 8 whole percent, that's not even a double digit, has come from earnings growth, because if you follow FactSet research, we're actually negative four quarters running in 19 and 92% of stocks' gains have come from valuation expansion, a lot of which began in mid-September and then again October the 11th, when Jay Powell announced that not only would the Fed be conducting overnight repo operations to ensure market liquidity, but that the Fed would actually start to grow its balance sheet by $60 billion a month. I'm just saying investors need to be very careful because they need to understand what's driving markets, which is not fundamentals.
Yeah, it's almost like a liquidity rush. At some point, if you were to look at catalysts, in other words, what could disrupt this market? What do you think that might be?
Well, I think that I'm actually going to agree with Janet Yellen for the first and last time in my life. Economic expansions don't die of old age, but they do tend to be driven by secular forces. And those secular forces tend to come and go, even as the cycles, because we've actually endured not one, but two industrial recessions in the current expansion. And that's never happened in post-war history. That's new, that we're able to skirt this. And to me, that is the effect of quantitative easing and a massive amount of liquidity that has been supportive of financial markets that has bled through to the real economy. So I think that means that we, because so much of this rally has been built on valuation and what I call hopium, it's led us that much more vulnerable to any kind of a financial event, which is easy enough to see occurring when you've doubled the size of your bond market from $5 to $10 trillion and increased total non-financial business debt in the country to a record 74%. Anything can happen when you build up that much leverage in the background. If you're nimble enough to go grab those fallen angels and get value from them, and right now the high yield bond market, by the way, could use some more components and inputs. But if you're able to take advantage of such value moves, then do so. But be very cautious of just being blindly in an S&P index fund, given what's driving the broader market.
You pointed out something you and I at one time believed, that in election years, the Fed is unlikely to move. Statistics have proven otherwise. Given an election year, presidents all want to get reelected. Either, you know, they spend more money, hence the tax cuts, or the Fed is stimulative most of the time. It's at least in a mode right now. Given this, what are the likely probabilities that we could have another good year, maybe not as good as this year, but at least a positive year for the markets? As you look at 2020, what do you see?
Well, I'm friendly with Michael Hartnett over at B of A Merrill. I'm of like minds with him that the first quarter could see a continuation of this melt-up that we've seen in stocks. It's very much a blind melt-up, but I don't necessarily see fundamental underpinnings into the rest of the year because of what's happening in the energy industry in the United States and because of what's happening in the automobile industry globally. So I don't see the ability of the economic data to satisfy the melt-up that we're anticipating in the first quarter of the year. Could I be wrong? Of course. Look, I had thought that we were going to be seeing serious slowing in the economy by the fourth quarter of this year. And in a million years, I said it out loud. I've said it to you. We saw double tightening. We saw quantitative tightening and rate hikes at the same time. In 2018, it's perfectly feasible that we see rate cuts and quantitative easing at the same time. But for heaven's sake, I didn't think he'd do it. And then he did. So anything is possible. And I can see Jay Powell ramping up quantitative easing in 2020 to be magnitudes of what it is. We could easily surpass $4.5 trillion on the Fed's balance sheet and keep going from there. Because again, he understands how dangerous the situation is in the credit markets and how easy it is to unleash systemic risk when we've had a leveraging up along the same magnitudes as what we had building up to the subprime crisis, but this time it's in corporate debt. I'm actually old enough, and so are you, to remember what happened in 1998 when the Fed pulled out all stops to try and keep the biggest stock market bubble in U.S. history going. And that's my concern. If we manage to make 1998 a parallel year with 2019, and therefore 2020 a parallel year with 1999, God help us in 2021, because we know that we'll have that much further to fall with double bubbles in stocks and bonds.
Couldn't agree with you more. Well, listen, Danielle, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks for coming on, and we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy Holiday.
The very same to you, Jim. I look forward to speaking to you in the new year.
Likewise.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on Smart Macro today is Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Officer at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, a month ago when we spoke with you, you were talking about how you were seeing an asymmetrical return profile for the market, that there was likely more upside ahead for the markets based on the fact that a lot of investors, when you look at fund flows, were positioned quite bearishly, and that this argued, again, for a more contrarian outcome with further upside in the stock market. We have certainly seen that since we spoke with you then. And then you also talked about how global growth looks like it has put in the bottom, especially when we look at global leading economic indicators. We had a number of charts that we'd showed our listeners. We're going to have a number of charts as well that we're going to post on financialsense.com today for our listeners to look at. If you would mind, give us an update on where things stand today. I know you had mentioned that you thought the U.S. still had some catch-up to do when we think about the leading economic indicator outlook. I know that you look at a number of different indicators for determining this. So give us an update. Where do things stand at present?
Well, looking at, I looked at a lot of global leading indicators just to see, you know, another month's gone by, how they're performing and tracking. And it does really look like we've seen a bottom in global growth, and it looks like it was around the August, September timeframe. We continue to see some improvement. There's several things that I keep track of consistently to see if that narrative is playing out. And that's commodity prices, global interest rates. Typically, they all tend to move in the same direction: growth, interest rates, inflation, commodities. And copper has been performing really well relatively over the last couple of weeks. Copper's, you know, often named Dr. Copper because it's got a PhD in economics. It's a great leading indicator. You know, if you look at the last cycle, copper bottomed in early 16, right around when global growth was bottoming. And it also peaked late in 2017 going into 2018, just as global growth was peaking. And it's been selling off ever since then, but it also bottomed around August, September timeframe. And copper's been moving up. Steel prices did take a hit earlier in the third and fourth quarter. They're now starting to move back up. Global interest rates, like the German bund yields, Japanese interest rates are moving up. All this is confirming that we are likely, you know, going to continue this improvement from the trough that we've seen in global growth earlier this year. And looking at that, what I think we're going to see is, though, that the U.S. economy is probably still going to be falling behind the rest of the world and essentially playing catch up on the downside. We peaked a lot later than the rest of the world. I'd say about September, you know, October-ish timeframe. 2018 is when the U.S. growth rate peaked, and we've been decelerating since. I think we're still kind of either, you know, go down a little bit more in growth rates or start to trade growth rates, see those go sideways. But I don't see an upturn yet in U.S. growth until probably the first to second quarter of next year. And this leads me to the belief, with U.S. growth now starting to underperform the global markets, that we would probably see some improvement in global equities relative to the U.S.
So regarding the global growth outlook, and as you said, copper prices are picking up. We're seeing interest rates abroad in various areas that are also picking up. This is arguing for a pickup in global growth. And you had mentioned on our show last time that when it comes to Financial Sense Wealth Management, how we're positioning our clients that you're moving more towards international emerging market bonds and various areas to take advantage of this pickup that you see. Are we seeing this? Where are the signs of this currently when you look at international stocks, emerging markets, and the like?
I'm certainly starting to see this in Europe. For example, the Stoxx 600, it's an index that has small, medium, and large cap companies, 600, all based in Europe. The Stoxx 600 just hit an all-time high. Its former high, it saw one in 2014, which was just marginally above the 2006-2007 high, which was also just marginally above the 99-2000 high. So if you look at the European stock market, it really hasn't gone anywhere for close to two decades. And we just saw a new high in that market, which means that we could probably see some significant movement ahead. Typically, that's what occurs after a breakout from a long-term base. Usually, the markets tend to perform quite well. Looking at the stocks, I believe it's the Stoxx Index, which is composed of 300 stocks, a little bit, you know, half the size of the Stoxx 600. That is not yet at a new all-time high. And so that means some of the larger cap names in Europe haven't quite moved yet. And so a lot of the improvement we're seeing are in the small, medium-sized companies in Europe. But I do expect Europe as a whole to really start to perform well over the next 6 months or so. And looking at new highs, new lows, I'm seeing a surge in 52-week highs, 3-month new highs, 1-month new highs. So a lot of strength I'm seeing internally in the European stock market. And the same goes for the Japanese stock market. Looking at the Nikkei index, we've seen 52-week highs surge to the highest in number of years. And also, I'm looking at the number of names within that index that are hitting 200-day highs. So this is, you know, a lot of people look at advanced decline lines. That's looking at stocks that are up or down based on price, which can be misleading. I'm looking at it based on 200-day new highs and new lows, and that is showing that there's a lot of strength there in the Nikkei. And while the European stock market hasn't really gone anywhere for two decades, the Japanese market hasn't gone anywhere for three decades. The former high in the Nikkei was back in 89, and currently the Nikkei is about just under 40% off of its highs from way back then. And so while I'm talking about a major base breakout in Europe, we might have even a more significant one in Japan. In 2018, the Nikkei hit its highest level since 91, and then we're starting to see improvement this year in the Nikkei, where I would not be surprised if the Nikkei breaks north of 25,000. And that would mean that there's really not much in resistance up until the former highs and set back in 89. So that means there's tremendous value in Europe. I think there's tremendous value in Japan. And broadening out, looking at the emerging market index, that set a high back in 2008, which has not been surpassed yet. So looking at that former high, the emerging market index is still about 13-14% off of its 2008 highs. That is dramatically different when you compare that to the S&P, which has had a tremendous run over the last decade, far surpassed any other market. And I think these other markets will start to play catch up, and certainly it looks like a lot more of an attractive value proposition than the U.S. market.
So we've seen a major breakout in Europe and Japanese stocks. That's significant, as you noted. I mean, we haven't seen them break out or hit these levels for decades, you know, a decade or more in Europe, two decades or more in Japan. So significant breakouts in these markets. And so there's better value, you believe, in these international markets. U.S. stock market has been hitting all-time record highs. As we know, things are a little bit on the frothy side as well. Valuations are going to be cheaper abroad. So that's much more of an attractive play in your mind. Anything else that you are considering when you think about allocating investments towards U.S. versus international stocks? Is this a valuation argument or otherwise?
It's certainly a valuation argument, as I mentioned. Foreign markets are so far, you know, significantly lower or haven't gone anywhere compared to the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years compared to the U.S. market, which has far surpassed their former highs. So, you know, value is not a timing call. You know, oftentimes something that's cheap can get cheaper and something that's expensive can get even more expensive. So I look for things to tell me that there's a turning point at hand. And one of those is relative growth rates, relative earnings rates, interest rate differentials between U.S. and foreign markets. But another very key element towards foreign markets outperforming the U.S. is the U.S. dollar. Typically, when the dollar is weak, we see outperformance in commodities. We see strong runs in foreign currencies, also in foreign markets relative to the U.S. So I pay close attention to what the U.S. dollar is doing. And to do that, I track the dollar relative to 30 other global currency pairs. And I'm looking at a homogeneous picture in terms of the dollar being weak compared to a whole host of currencies, not, for example, just the euro or the yen. And so looking at multiple time frames, over the last month, I'm seeing the dollar declining to relatively, I'd say, about 90% of global currencies. And the chart that I'm referring to is a table looking at foreign currencies relative to the dollar, and we'll have that up on the website. But I don't just look at performance, I also look at moving averages as a measure for breadth. And I look at 10-day, 20-day, 50-day, 100-day, and 200-day moving averages just to see what percentage of foreign currencies are above those moving averages relative to the dollar. And as you'll see when you visit the website, there's a whole sea of green. You know, very few currencies are below key moving averages relative to the dollar. On a 200-day basis, which is pretty good for a one-year trading period, I'd say about 85 to 90% are above their long-term moving averages. Pretty much the same for looking at 100-day or 50-day. And even on the short-term time frame, 20-day moving averages, 10-day, there's still roughly, I would say, 80 to 90% of global currencies are above their moving averages relative to the dollar. So that tells me this is a very broad message of dollar weakness compared to foreign currencies. And looking at foreign currencies, you know, they're of value as well, not just the equity, foreign equity markets. A lot of currencies are at 10, 20, 30-year lows to the dollar. So I think we can get some significant return coming from currencies. And so from a U.S. investor perspective, when you invest in foreign markets, not only do you get the return of that market, but you get the currency return added to that being priced in euros or yen, unless you're in some hedged foreign investment. So I think based on that, that the message is confirming that we're likely to see outperformance from foreign markets relative to the U.S.
So Chris, boil all this down to us in terms of investment implications. Obviously, as you had said before on our podcast, that you are allocating more capital to international stocks, to emerging market bonds, and you just went through some of the reasons for that. Give us an update on where things stand in terms of what Financial Sense Wealth Management is doing currently based on what you just said.
Well, you know, last year we were predicting a peak in global growth, which is why we were divesting from international exposure in the early part of 2018. All year we've been slowly kind of allocating to global markets as we saw the value there and also the expected turning point in global growth, which we've seen. So we have allocated or reallocated a significant portion of our accounts towards foreign markets and also even more towards equities. We had a more of a defensive posture for the bulk of the year, more in fixed income, but we're taking away from fixed income, adding that to the equity side of the equation for our balanced accounts and moving more into foreign equities, not just equities, but also foreign debt. I think there's a lot more attractiveness in terms of yield and value in foreign debt markets than the U.S., particularly the developing, not the developed like Europe, where yields are in negative territory. And we're looking at increasing our exposure even further to foreign markets. But the market right now, both in the U.S. and abroad, is pretty elevated. Sentiment's getting a little frothy. So we're going to be looking for some kind of a short-term pullback in the market before adding even more exposure to international markets.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you again for coming on to Smart Macro and giving us an update on Financial Sense Wealth Management's view and outlook, what you're doing for clients. Again, I want to note that we're going to have a series of charts located on financialsense.com. If any of you want to look at some of the charts that we discussed, whether or not it's the comparison of the U.S. dollar against 30 different currencies and the broad-based dollar weakness. Of course, there are a number of implications here when you think about emerging market, outperformance, commodities, and a wide range of different implications there in addition to some other charts that we discussed today. So Chris, it was a pleasure having you on. And if any of our listeners want to get in touch with you to find out more about our investment services or to discuss your outlook, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give me a call at 1-888-486-3939.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.